Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhumann, sharing stories of our food.
And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhumann. Well, it's June here in the Northeast, and gets me thinking about camping, actually. Gets me thinking about doing some fun things. Hitting the Whites, the Green Mountains, coastal Maine, the Berkshires, Finger Lakes, even Boston Harbor Islands. There are so many great places to camp. And actually, it gets me thinking about when I was a kid. We did a lot of camping as a kid. And to be honest, I haven't done enough with our kids. But I'm going to try to remediate that over the summer. Camping is a great time, obviously, to unplug, to detach. It feeds the soul, gets us connected, sit around the campfire. It's good stuff. So one thing I want to comment about this and thinking about and correlating to what we're talking about here in Sourcing Matters is decades ago when I went camping with my family, before there were those electronics, I used to roam out of our campsite and walk down to the local hub where there'd be a store or, you know, a small restaurant and even a little arcade to play. And I would kind of try to make friends, hang out with some buddies. But I remember going in there, and everything in there was just the low-cost version, the high-fructose corn syrup, the processed, the crap food that we see in abundance at basically most convenience stores. And it was not much different than most of the restaurants that were there. So, effectively, if you didn't bring your own food, which we did for the most part, but it was nice to go down and try to find some new places to hang out and have a little food, you were eating this junk. And what's kind of happened, and what you've seen this correlation is, whether you're traveling on a campground or stopping at a rest stop or every time you fly, unless you did bring your own food, you're basically consuming that energy and nothing around your health. And what I found is, we traveled the country, went up through Canada, we went all through the South. We did a lot of camping. My parents are teachers, so we spent a lot of times in the summer camping. And whether that was in Las Vegas in the city, or in the Bay of Fundy in Nova Scotia, or a rural KOA in the Corn Palace of Mitchell, South Dakota, what I saw was that food was a bit of a looking glass of the future of what we've seen. And over the last 40 years, we've continued to lose more of those values, this erosion, which has percolated from those on-site convenience stores and restaurants, like at the campgrounds, or really just anywhere where convenience is changing our association with better food, has basically left a vast lifestyle imprint on what we eat at home now. And what we do focus here on Sourcing Matters, obviously, is looking at the solutions of change. And there are some beacons of hope. And we've seen owners of different establishments reinvigorating their marketing push, using food to appeal the next generation of travelers or adventurers or consumers or campers. And if there's any question if those macro trends are happening, just take a walk through the airport and stop by Hudson News, which used to be the same kind of convenience, the high fructose corn syrup, the junk, the crap food that you get, which now you walk in there and there's organic snacks, there's real foods, there's grass-fed yogurt, there's kombucha, which you can have basically behind the security gate now at JFK. Now that is a drastic sea change that's happening within our food. So the question arises, whether you're camping or at the airport or just even at your local Five and Dime or your grocery store, who is going to produce this differentiated food raised with elevated standards to meet the new consumer's interest? Who's going to train tomorrow's farmers to get us there? And who's going to make sure that we have a stable enough climate, healthy soils, clean water to service not just the demands for these travelers, but everyone seeking nutritious food to keep our kids healthy? Well, We've been very lucky on Sourcing Matters to get some incredible guests that are really the experts, the thought leaders in the space, dealing with coming from different epicenters focused on regenerative agriculture and food system reform. And today is no different. Today we welcome two guests who are running a marquee example of sustainable coastal farming that has works to, as they say on the website, to transform our relationship with farming and food to transform a planet. And what I've seen by being up there a few times and visiting this is that they also work to amplify, educate, and curate this approach. Give you a chance to talk about this. So today's guest, we have Fiona Wilson, who is the chair of the board at Wolf's Neck Center, the executive director, for the Center of Social Innovation and Enterprise, and an associate professor at the Paul College of Business and Economics at the University of New Hampshire. Hey, Fiona, how are you?
Hey, Aaron. It's great to talk to you. Thanks for having us on the show.
Hey, no problem. And joining Fiona is Dave Herring, who's the executive director of Wolf's Neck Center. Hey, Dave, how are you?
I'm great, Aaron.
Well, good. Hey, thanks. Thanks you too for putting up with my long intro, but I was trying to weave together some of the things we got going on at Wolf's Neck up in Freeport, Maine. You know, which is interesting, I think a lot of people hear Freeport, Maine, and they think one thing. It's usually outlet shopping. But what you guys got going on there is something pretty unique, pretty exciting, pretty enthusiastic about the future of coastal farming communities, but really around food systems, around local food movement, around regional food movement, and instances for creating innovation economies. So I wanted to give a chance to talk about this. And I'm going to read a quick blurb if I can, and then we'll jump into some of the questions and ask you a little bit more about the history and some of the vision of this. But from what I saw, Wolf's Neck Center is situated on over 600 acres of preserved coastal landscape in Freeport, Maine. Wolf's Neck Center uses the setting to connect people of all ages to the food they eat and where it comes from. As a nonprofit, Wolf's Neck Center draws upon a rich history of innovation and experimentation to continue the legacy of this place today. And through regenerative farming, innovative soil health research, and visitor interaction, the land is now used as an educational resource to create a healthier planet for all. And that's excellent. That's exciting. That correlates to so much what we're focused on in amplifying the storylines and really trying to democratize these things to bring it to a larger audience to let them know, wow, this is all connecting through our food. So Fiona, I wanted to start with you if I could and ask you, if you could share a bit about the history of Wolf's Neck, this unique parcel, and then also how you were involved and how this basically came to current form as a research center. So if you would share a little bit about the history, we'd appreciate that.
Yeah, of course, I'd love to. It's a really great story, I think. Back in the 1940s, a family from Philadelphia, the Smith family, particularly Lawrence M.C. and his wife, Eleanor Houston Smith, they decided to invest in some property here in Maine. They were able to buy about 275 acres that were some farming parcels of farmland. And a little later, they bought another almost 200 acres a few years later. And they were really early proponents of organic and sustainable farming. They'd been inspired by some of the work of Lewis Bromfield and at Malabar Farm, some of the writings he was doing in the 1930s. And the Smiths, really saw, in addition to the rationale for farming in a more natural, holistic way without pesticides, they also saw that the land on the coast of Maine, particularly farming land, was really starting to dwindle. And they saw that, a lot of that farming land was being turned over for housing developments and this beautiful open space and the ability for this farmland to be productive economic land for Maine farmers, and just also for people, the general public's access to that kind of beautiful open land was really under threat, and so they decided to buy up these parcels of farmland and to try and preserve it, and not just the working farm aspect of it, but also the historic nature of some of the buildings on the farm to really preserve that historic landscape. And so they thought they would do a few things with the land, but ultimately they decided to start producing organic beef cattle. Remember their beef operation began really in sort of the early 1950s. So this was a good decade before Rachel Carson published The Silent Spring. So they they went through a lot of interesting experiments, I would say, and I think you referenced that in your introduction, Aaron, that this is a place that has a history of innovation and experimentation. The Smiths were in the early 70s. They were one of the they were the first farm to bring a round hay baler to Maine, for example. Also in the 1960s, the family sued the Central Maine Power Company, who at the time were using pesticides on the land where the power lines were, and they successfully sued the Maine Power Company just to prevent them from using pesticides on Wolf Neck land. So have just been and also experimenting with different approaches to silage. So all along the way, they really were experimenters in sustainable farming. In 1985, they actually decided to make a gift of this incredible property to the University of Southern Maine. And the University of Southern Maine operated it for about a decade as a research and educational institution. And then for a lot of reasons that I won't go into, the farm was given back to the foundation in 1996. And so 1996 is really kind of the new era for Wolf Neck Farm Foundation. It formed a new board, had new management, and they started to more deliberately build education programs, but also started to grow the organic beef business here as well. And one of the other things that was sort of a piece of experimentation here at Wolf Neck was that in the early 2000s, they created a marketing alliance that was called the Wolf Neck Farm Natural Meats brand. And it was a way not only to sell naturally raised meats from here at Wolf Neck, but also naturally raised meats from other local farmers. And that was a really big commercial success. It had pretty wide distribution, at least here on the East Coast. It was at a time when consumers were starting to investigate more natural meat options. And that continued for a number of years. Ultimately, in 2007, that natural meats business was sold to Pineland Farms, which is an operating entity of a large nonprofit called the Libra Foundation. And since that time, since 2007, we have been operating here at Wolf Neck Farm as an educational institution around organic and sustainable farming.
That's great. So, Fiona, I think that's, you touched on some key aspects. It's such a unique spot, right? I mean, it's pretty relatively close to Portland. It's a large piece of contiguous land. And the setting is absolutely stunning. Your cows have some of the best views, I think, basically on the East Coast. It has to be. It's an unbelievable spot. And I'm intrigued to know more. Dave, if you could share a bit about, let's fast forward to current day and looking at, you've established yourself as being a working laboratory. You have many things going on. Could you share with our audience a bit of what you're doing now on a day-to-day, but also the grander vision of where you think this can go in the next decade?
Yeah, I'm happy to, Aaron. Wolf's Neck, as Fiona kind of outlined a bit in her intro and as you did as well, is a terrifically unique place. I mean, not only is it a coastal farm, which is unique in and of itself, but it's a nonprofit education center and coastal farm with a campground adjacent to a 200-some-odd acre state park, one of the most visited state parks in the Maine state park system. So what you have there is this intersection of a number of different ecosystems with a number of different audiences. And, I think it's been just over the last handful or more of years where, I think we have found ways to connect the work happening here at Wolf's Neck Center with broader societal issues facing farming and food. And each time that we discover a new area for us to expand into or connect our work to, I think that we're continually inspired by all the opportunities that are out there for us. When you think about having 20 to 30,000 visitors coming every year to this nonprofit working educational farm, and those visitors are coming from a variety of different backgrounds and from different parts of the country, you know, it gives us an opportunity to use the work that's happening here and really hope to inspire those visitors and have them go away changed with a newfound understanding for the role that each of us plays in on this earth and within our food system. So certainly from a programmatic perspective, the organization has been heavily focused on the visitor, our visitor and community education programming. Additionally, we've got an amazing farm camp that'll see, we'll see about 700 kids who will come through here this year as part of our a week-long day camp experience where for ages 4 to 14, where they're connecting with this place and connecting with where food comes from, as you guys said, and experiencing time along the coast. And it was about 3 years ago that, 3 or 4 years ago, that we got connected to our friends at Stonyfield, you know, housed next door, the next state over in New Hampshire, and started understanding more about the organic dairy sector. And really for us, I think the program that we launched with them and with funding from their previous parent company, the Organic Dairy Resident Organic Dairy Research and Farmer Training Program, is the country's first residential organic dairy farmer training program. And so it was the first kind of workforce development program that we launched, really trying to attract the next generation of food producers here to Wolf's Neck to train as part of a two-year apprenticeship to become organic dairy farmers here in Maine or in New England or elsewhere throughout the country. So that's probably our newest program and an exciting one certainly for us and for the community and for Maine at large. And as part of that, we've really started to expand our work around research, kind of drawing on our history and our heritage around innovation and experimentation. And so we've partnered with folks at UNH and with Tufts and elsewhere to launch some research programs specifically around soil health and ecosystem services and really trying to find ways to quantify the impacts that farmers have on their land and help them move towards a more adaptive management style and practice. So I think we're likely going to talk more about that, but that's kind of a brief introduction. And I would say it, in general, or from a very large scale perspective, the work that we're trying to do here is really focused on connecting people of all ages to where their food comes from, but also trying to help every farm become a research farm and every farm become a training farm, because we really feel like that's what it's going to take for us to help usher in this transformational change that needs to happen within our food system.
I do want to get more into, as you said, the training program. That's a very exciting evolution. We're talking about a new operating model for implementing, whether it's dairy or really any regenerative best practice on dealing with natural resources. I also want to get into the specifics about what you're doing in this research center around soil health, around sequestering carbon, around water clarity. But let's start, if we could. It's key, I think, for our audience to know that you run a production farm. You do focus on dairy up at Wolf's Neck, and you are focused on trying to teach this next generation of farmers proper practices, proper stewardship, how to best work with what they have for those regenerative natural resources, and also the ecosystem out there. So one thing I think that is starting to come to light for the general audience is the current state of dairy. So, you know, we've got 75,000 dairies in the U.S. And what we've seen in the last few years, especially in our region in the Northeast, or really any region that has smaller farms, is the perils of the family-owned small, mid-sized dairy in the Northeast is real. And it needs a fresh look.
Of those 75,000 dairies that are out there, about 3,000 of those have over 500 head and represent about 50% of the total liquid milk output. So we've got a very small percentage, 1% or maybe 1.5% of the dairies that are actually representing 50% of the output. So what we have seen as a collective in our region, maybe being the tip of the spear, is a bit of a forced innovation model, like your brethren that have done up in the Maine ocean fisheries, where there has to be some kind of an evolution towards differentiation to meet an evolving consumer interest, to find ways of lowering operating expense, but really finding a way to get out of the heavy hand of the milk board and finding a way to look at treatment of animals and their living environments as a differentiator, the forage type that these ruminants are eating, the raw form of dairy itself, local proximity, having a local dairy where you get everything in glass bottles, or even value adds like yogurts and artisanal cheeses. So leading up to that and saying, you mentioned that you have your partners, obviously Stonyfield, which has been probably, with Gary Hirschberg's leadership, one of the first and probably one of the more progressive groups to use that differentiated model in yogurt to change what the yogurt complexity looks like in what we get in a grocery store compared to what raw milk looks like. And Danone, the previous owner, who I think provided some grant money for you, having doing this at a global scale, having diverse offerings where they really have focused on pasture-based animals and regenerative-based practice. So, Dave, could you share a bit more about the distribution and supply chain you've begun to evolve up in Freeport, Maine, with those vested partners, and how you're leveraging that differentiation to then proliferate amongst your teaching practices, your educational programs, your research center? If you could share a bit of the audience of how that then builds across the board.
Sure. Lots to talk about there, Aaron. I thought this was only an hour-long call, but I guess we're going to go longer than that.
Take the time you need. Yes, it's, and with my monologues to start, what you don't hear is the people don't hear the hour and a half that we put on the cutting floor, right?
Gotcha. Well, so maybe I'll start with saying that, you know, this model of dairies getting fewer and larger, which you kind of touched on briefly as well there, with the number of dairies, I think you said it was 3,000 dairies, over 500 cows, I think is the stat that you shared, that, you know, that's not really working in Maine or New England's favor for the most part. You know, Maine and New England are not really set up for, from kind of a geographical and topographical perspective, aren't really set up for big ag in that way. And so the decline of the smaller scale dairies, kind of those what we would call kind of the small to medium size, or I guess really technically a medium sized dairy, it's like a 60 to 120 cow dairy. That decline over the last couple of decades, and then some, has really kind of wreaked havoc on the agricultural economy here in the region. And that's where, when we got into some discussions with Stonyfield, and they started thinking about, okay, 5 and 10 and 20 years down the road, where is their supply going to come from, and are they going to be able to get it regionally? Because they didn't necessarily want to have to be getting milk from California or from Midwest or the further west, and bringing it all the way to their plant in Londonderry in New Hampshire. So they really started to look at that as well, and you know, I think that our partnership with them is a really prime example of where a nonprofit and a for-profit institution like Stonyfield can find crossover in their strategic goals as well as strategic challenges and opportunities. And so for Stonyfield, thinking about their long-term supply and wanting to see more small and medium-sized family-run dairies out there, for us, an organization like Wolf's Neck Center, also wanting to kind of find ways that our work can help strengthen the agricultural economy here in Maine and New England, was a really good fit for both of us. And so we launched this training program a few years ago, and I guess it was in 2015 now that we launched it. And the focus really is on production, and improving production practices, management practices, and the approach to production, so that farmers are able to stay competitive in a changing marketplace, because it obviously is changing, and there's been a number of changes that are not working in the farmer's favor over the last decade or more. And so our focus is on, it's on organic, and it's on pasture-based management. And so really trying to train farmers to utilize their pasture resources in a way that helps both with their bottom line, but also helps build soil health and soil organic matter. And it produces a healthier product and healthier animals, lo and behold. So, you know, it's one of those solutions that fits a number of different challenges. And when we launched that program, we launched it in partnership with Dairy Grazing Apprenticeship, which is a national program based out of Wisconsin, funded initially through some funding from USDA and the Beginning Farmer and Rancher Development Program. And their model is to qualify a private farmer to be a master, and that master then has access to a pool of applicants for the apprenticeship program, and then when an apprentice is placed on their farm, or they essentially hire an apprentice to come work with them, they're basically taking on the responsibility of this, of helping guide them through a 2-year training program, which is basically a guided pathway to farm management and ownership. And the goal really is to help create this next generation of organic dairy farmers who can take over these farms. And so for a number of apprentices, and there's about, I think, right around 150 dairy grazing apprenticeship farms out there. And we were the first in New England. At the time that we were launching our program and we connected with them, they had just gotten some funding to expand out of the upper Midwest and begin to expand towards the east. And so at the time they were in Wisconsin and Missouri, I think Minnesota, a couple other states, but they hadn't expanded further east. But we had received this funding from Stonyfield and their parent company, or their then parent company, and so we at that time got into some discussions with them and basically became the New England hub for the dairy grazing apprenticeship. And since then, we have expanded the program here to all New England states, and there are about right now, I think, around 15 dairy grazing apprenticeship sites here in New England. Of course, we are the only nonprofit educational farm within the mix, both here in New England and nationally. So that gives us some opportunities to provide additional support and training for farms and farmers that are interested in joining that network. And so we see over the next several years, we want that number 15 to quadruple. We want to have 100 or more dairy grazing apprenticeship sites here in New England on farms that are owned and operated by farmers who are aging. You know, the national average of a dairy farmer is approaching 60. And for a lot of those farmers, they don't have a plan to get to transition out of the sector. And for a lot of them, their 401k is the ground beneath their feet, and the cows that are in their pasture, and their facilities and infrastructure, and their ability and our ability to work with them to find and train this next generation is really what's going to give them the opportunity to transition out of the industry and retire when they're ready, but also, and maybe equally as important, to keep these farms working. Because if we continue to see the decline of these mid-scale, mid-sized family farms here in New England, that's going to mean more likely than not that the fewer and larger phenomenon is going to continue to wreak havoc, and that Stonyfield or other companies might not have any other choice but to go further afield for their milk.
Hmm.
And I know that that's not what they want.
I love the strategy, Dave. By keeping it so that an organization that needs this for their distribution channel, the integrity of their distribution channel, they can help vertically integrate it through this type of a research center. It behooves them. It's a value. But I, you know, we also know that those organizations are investing in longer horizon concepts too. It's not just the immediate buck. There's associated values to that. I want to ask, if I could, how successful have you seen that apprenticeship and training program be in having a ripple effect on the industry? You had mentioned the average age of the farmer being near 60 or even over 60 for some of our dairymen who might be set in their ways. There's a certain model of doing traditional New England dairy that has received some tweaks with a regenerative best pastoral approach to raising animals for dairy. So have you seen that in passing of education or building your network or encouraging more in-family succession for folks that may want to be in organic or regenerative farming rather than traditional conventional farming?
You know, yes and no. I mean, I think it's early days for us here with this program, and especially when you think about the fact that it's a two-year program, and so our first apprentice to complete the program actually just completed it earlier this spring, and she's actually gone on to work for Casella Organics, which is a supplier of organic agricultural products across New England, and I think the next apprentices that are going to complete the program, we expect to land on farms here in Maine. I think that it's likely that they will, and so some of the signs that I think we're seeing that would indicate that we're on the right track include the growth in the number of farms that are joining the network and the interest in more farms to join. So I think I mentioned that we've got about 15 farms that have joined this network, the Dairy Grazing Apprenticeship Network, but we've got probably another dozen who are in the process of joining that network. It's not a decision that they take lightly, because it's a kind of a new approach for securing labor for their farm, but also potentially to training their successor. So there are probably, like I said, another dozen or so that are looking to join the network. So I think that's one certainly strong indication that we're on the right path. Another one is that we are increasingly looked to here at Wolf's Neck Center to be a convener and host events and host pasture walks and different trainings for people in the sector. So the Northeast Pasture Consortium is hosting their training here. They're a week-long program that they've got coming up this summer. The Maine Dairy Guild, or the Maine Cheese Guild, I should say, is hosting their annual festival here coming up in September, and there are several other examples as well where the work that we're doing here and the fact that there's a training program amidst a working organic dairy farm. That's heavily focused on soil health and on pasture-based management. We're seeing from just a number of groups that the world needed a place like this, or at least this region needed a place like this, because I know that there are similar models out there that we're aware of and that we connect with when we can. But I think that those are two examples that. And hopefully there will be many, many more to come that we're on the right path with this training program.
Yeah, that's Fiona, please, yeah.
May I jump in? Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, I think a couple of things just to add to that. There was an example last year when a Maine or dairy farm, organic dairy farmer, had a very bad accident, and he was a single farmer operator, and he was facing many weeks, maybe even months, really not being able to operate his dairy. And so he was able to contact Wolf's Neck, and one of our trainees actually went over and spent time helping him operate his farm until he was back on his feet. So I think it's a small anecdotal story, but I think it's about sort of growing that set of resources around here, around the region, so that when something like that happens, rather than that farm going out of business, there's a young trainee who can sort of step in and help that farm operate until the farmer is, you know, back to health. Mm-hmm. But I think just in general terms, you know, a question about, you know, seeing the impact, you know, and as Dave mentioned, this program's only a couple of years old. And I think that's sort of the point and part of the value that we can bring as a nonprofit, which is rebuilding the organic dairy sector in New England is inherently a multi-decade kind of process, right? And I think it's a for-profit farm really couldn't take on that task. And I'm just really happy that, you know, as a nonprofit, we have sort of the mission and also the resources that allow us to make that sort of multi-decade commitment. When we look at the projections, you know, we may be graduating 4 or 5 trainee farmers a year. The real impact of that really doesn't start to hit, right, for 10 years down the road. But it's really vital work, and I'm just really glad that, you know, we can take on that work in partnership with somebody like Stonyfield, who, you know, as I would say, as a for-profit corporation, they are pretty unusual in their long-term vision about thinking about, you know, their supply chain and also just the health of the industry, multiple decades in the future. I mean, not many corporations are thinking in those time frames, but I think more corporations need to be thinking in those time frames if we are going to have a sustainable food system in the years to come.
Yeah, absolutely. Fascinating. It's exciting, as you said, if it's the ripple effect across the entire region of rebuilding the infrastructure to have that support system, that safety net, to have a network, a convening location, just to know that it's possible, that this is happening again, and there's going to be a great opportunity for a future of agriculture and farming in this region is essential. So that's fantastic work that you're accomplishing with that. So Fiona, I had mentioned in the beginning of the conversation, I was talking about camping, and camping can take you out in the middle of the woods, or it can put you in kind of a contrived experience in nature, but not at Wolf Neck. You've got some great locations there. You can get easy access to the research and research center and farm. But your campground also has some differentiated products inside the store. So it seems that, to me at least, this is pretty accessible and attainable agrotourism. Can you tell us a little bit more about the campground, how that operates, and some of the enthusiasm you're seeing that people that stay at the campground then come to the research center, or vice versa?
Yeah, of course. So the campground was started by the Smith family, when they still owned this property back in the 1950s. And it was really driven by their passionate belief that that the public should have access to beautiful natural places. And I think, you know, we carry that belief on today, that, you know, we can't expect or ask people to sort of protect the environment unless they truly appreciate and enjoy the environment. And so for us, you know, the campground is, but also, you know, the many miles of hiking trails and just the open access, the free open access to the farm that we offer the public is all part of that mission to really allow people to, you know, first appreciate and then get more engaged with the natural world. The campground is spectacular. We're lucky. We have about 6 miles of shorefront on which most of the campsites sit. There's a couple of hundred campsites here today. They look out over the beautiful waters of Casco Bay at low tide. You know, the campers can go down onto the shore and look at some of the things on the rocky shore down below. It's really a beautiful place. We also have kayaks and canoes that campers can either bring their own or they can rent from us. There are bikes that campers can rent and cycle around the property. So it's a really beautiful place. And then obviously right behind them are these beautiful fields where we have our dairy cows, but also some of our sheep and our laying hens. And we also have a vegetable and fruit production garden that is literally right behind some of the campsites. And so it really is, you know, you're camping on the ocean with all that offers, but you're also camping right on a working farm. I think, you know, for many years that the campground and the farm were somewhat separate. I mean, although they're co-located, they sort of operated somewhat separately. But I think in the last 5 years or so, since Dave has been our executive director, and we had a strategic vision as a board, we've really been bringing those two things much more closely together. And there's a lot more opportunities for people who are coming to camp here to go and watch the afternoon milking in the dairy parlor, or to one of my favorites is to go and take a hike in the woods with some of the goats from the farm, or to go and take a tour of the vegetable and fruit production garden and pick some vegetables and do some food production with one of our educators. So it really is a kind of a great opportunity, I think, for people to come and camp here and learn about a working farm, eat food from a working farm. You mentioned that the store, so we have a small camp store and also a seasonal farm cafe. A few years ago, we really reinvented the farm cafe so that it was sourcing product both from here at Wolfneck Farm, but also some other local sustainable producers. So come late June, you can go down to the farm cafe and get an amazing farm pizza, which is sort of a pizza with all kinds of fresh seasonal veggies on it and Wolfneck lamb sausage and all kinds of great things. So it really is a great opportunity for people to come here, and especially for families with kids, I think, to be able to really get something educational out of a really enjoyable weekend or week here.
Hmm. It sounds fantastic. You should be on the tourism board, Fiona. That was great. I think we can show up and have incredible food, great walking tours. I would guess, though, there's probably a little more availability for those campsites in January compared to June or July, right? I'm sure you book up pretty quick. So if folks want to get those, we'll talk about at the end how they can maybe book some of those campsites. Dave, I want to close out with our last question for you here. I want to go back to your learning laboratory concept and what's happening with putting dairy animals back out on pasture, the values that we're talking about for investing in regenerative agriculture for soil health and water quality and carbon sequestration. It seems to have gained more traction. I mean, we obviously on our show have had some excellent guests that talk about this, but everyone has their own tweak to this, and everyone's doing it with different types of production animals. So if we look at dairy, for instance, and we go back to that stat that we've got 75,000 dairies, that's a collection of about 9.1 million cows, dairy cows that we have in the U.S. So I want to ask you, just to put this more of a speculative conversation or your vision of what could happen here if we were able to get many of the majority of those animals, that is 9.1, obviously do not live in pastured environments. They're usually put in a more confined environment. It's not the same experience that we would see at Wolfneck or some of the more progressive groups that are focused on animal wellness to create a better protein. So, but what would happen if we were able to get those 9 million translators of nutrient cycling back out on the lands and remediating the practice? Would we see vast change in our lands, our soils, our cleanliness of water? And this is a very leading question, but would the unintended consequence then be a healthier food and more stable environment? Is that the theory?
Well, I think so, Aaron, especially, having listened to some of your previous podcasts and having had the pleasure of listening to Alan Savory and others talk about similar topics. I mean, this is certainly a vision that's certainly a vision that we share and that we're trying to play out here and kind of be the change that we want to see in the world here at Wolfneck Center. And so, yeah, I mean, if you think about taking the majority of those cows that are confined and putting them back on pasture and allowing them to mimic nature in the way that they are raised but done so with the knowledge that we now have about intensive grazing management and about the opportunity that we have to add nutrients back into the soil, I think we'd see all of that. I think we'd see a healthier, more stable supply of milk. We'd see a more vibrant agricultural sector. I think we would see farm families running more viable businesses, because really what it comes down to when you're grazing cows is that you're utilizing your pasture resources and working with the animals to run the operation, as opposed to being an actor within a complex global commodity where the price of grain is gonna change pretty dramatically, or could change pretty dramatically, so the opportunity that the farmers have to put their cows back out on pasture and utilize their pasture resources to their advantage is one that is to their advantage, but also to the advantage of the consumer and the planet.
Listen to Alan explain it as it's the management and not the animals is a pretty concise way of describing, right? We've broken a system, whereas we really have an incredible opportunity to engage our soils for many of the biggest environmental issues that we have. And as said, the unintended consequences, we're healthier. We have a more sustainable regenerative system associated to it. So, that is excellent stuff. And I know that you're really starting to spool that up. And I'm intrigued to see how you continue to grow this and continue to daisy chain and work with those other epicenters that are maybe have different focus in the agricultural model that they're using, dairy versus beef cattle, or more regenerative, multidimensional farm outputs. But all exciting evolutions, and it does feel like we're in the midst of a large scale agricultural revolution, which is exciting for us and obviously exciting for all of our kids. So as I dust off my camping equipment, it's safe to say that unless we're headed to Wolf Neck Farm and campground in Freeport, Maine, then we'll be bringing our own food. What I will do is I will come up to Wolf Neck. I will bring the kids up. We'll stay at some point. We'll have that world-class views. We'll have the best food in the world, no false pretenses, no expensive, pretentious agritourism experience right there in Freeport, not too far from any of the greater Boston area, and obviously worth a trip up from New York just to experience it. So I can't thank you both enough for partaking in today's Sourcing Matters conversation. Fiona, maybe you could share a little bit about, if you would, some of the work you're doing at UNH and where people could learn more about that.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I'd love to. So, as you mentioned at the beginning, I'm a professor of sustainable business and social enterprise at UNH, but I also head up our Center for Social Innovation and Enterprise. And it's really a center that is founded on the premise that, a great education is going to continue to be vital. But what that great education consists of today is sort of evolving. And so while it's always going to be vital that students kind of graduate with that competence and that deep knowledge of a discipline, whether it's of finance or it's sociology or it's an agricultural discipline, that is sort of necessary but not sufficient, and that we really need to help graduate students who can be creative problem solvers and change agents in the world. The good news is, this generation of students are graduating with a profound awareness of the challenges we face as a society, but they're also graduating with a real hunger to make a positive impact. I think sometimes, though, they lack the knowledge and the toolkit, if you like, to know about how to be a change agent. So the focus of our work at UNH is really on getting students sort of out of the classroom and out of their comfort zone, and really to start to be able to use some of the great stuff they've learned in the classroom, and what we call experiential learning, or learning by doing. So we're focused on partnering them with businesses and nonprofits, and getting them out into the community, working on real problems and helping develop real solutions.
Innovative and agile, maybe nimble way of education. And yes, I think you're right. You learn a great deal from falling forward. So why not, right? Jump in there and get it done, especially when it's something as important as saving our shared and shrinking planet.
Dave, could you share with our audience if we have an aspirational dairyman or woman, if we have folks that run a farm that may have interest in getting an apprentice, or people that just want to come up and learn more about what you're doing at your wonderful working laboratory, where can they learn more about Wolfsnack?
They can obviously go to our website at wolfsnack.org or check us out on social media. And love to host you, Aaron, and the family up here for a camping experience this year. And obviously you can go on wolfsnack.org as well, or you can just call me or email me, and I'd be happy to help facilitate that.
I appreciate that greatly. Well, I learned a great deal. I know our audience well, and I'm hoping that you'll get some more folks to come up and visit after today's chat. But I thank you both for partaking in today's conversation, and I look forward to our next conversation.
Thanks so much, Aaron. Great to talk to you as always.
Thank you. Take care.